But tonight, we have our own Robert Schmidt, Getting Real with Love. Rob is the director of Taiya Meditation Center, which is the organization that founded and created Many Rivers Books and Tea. He's been a spiritual practitioner for over 30 years, right? And operating in a teaching capacity for at least 20 or more of those years. And has also, in his spare time, managed to get a doctorate in archaeology, publish a book, famous book called Archaeologies of Sexuality. And he's been quoted on the backs of books that we sell in the store and is actually working on a book about some of our teaching. So without further ado, let's welcome Rob Schmidt, Getting Real with Love.
Thank you, Stuart. Well, I hope I can satisfy any expectations you might have had, given that generous introduction. But here I am to bring bad news about love. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. The last thing we want to hear. Or maybe bad news. At least at the start, it might be considered to be bad news. Because the instigation for this talk actually has been some of the work I've been doing with some of our Taiyu students lately. And I've been observing these struggles with this topic of love for many years, of course, on my own, in my own life, and have had occasion to make about as many mistakes, maybe not as many as some, but plenty by any standards. And so I have seen the bad news of love for myself, in person, up front, and therefore I can speak about it with some authority and assurance. And I can also speak about some of the other aspects of love as well. But the first thing, of course, that we have to acknowledge, or that I want to want you to consider, as might be the first thing to acknowledge, is that the ways we generally think about love, to start with, tend to lead us to anything but love. They arise out of illusion, and they take us into misfortune. I even hate to bring it up, but there was a very, very sad story in the papers a few weeks ago about a woman in the East Bay who, middle-aged mother, lovely-looking woman from her photos, and she had a teenage son, and she murdered herself and her son, I believe, on Mount Diablo. And everyone, according to the reports that I read, couldn't believe that this had happened about this woman. She had everything. She had what it took to define love. Surely no one doubted her love for her son. And yet this event. So how do we talk about love if that sort of thing can happen in its name? We don't even know the reasons exactly why she did this. And even if we did, I'm not sure, you know, even if we had her to interrogate now, her spirit or whatever, I'm not sure that we would receive any clarity about that. But that does not mean that there's no clarity to be had from this example and the other examples that we have in our own lives. For myself, I came to spiritual practice because I had grown up deciding that the only validation that really meant anything to me was to have a permanent lifelong committed relationship. And so at age 21, when I hooked up with the guy who I thought was going to be the object of this story, and 2 years later discovered that it wasn't all working out the way I'd hoped, that I think was the instigation for me to come to spiritual practice, because I realized just how clueless I was. Even though I had tried to do what I thought people were supposed to do when they loved another person, and even though I thought the impulses and ideas and behaviors that I had engaged in were examples of love, and that my partner had engaged in, I thought those were examples of love, yet they proved to be something other than what I expected. And so I think that ripened me, that encounter with reality ripened me for spiritual practice, although I didn't know it when I met my teacher. I wasn't looking for spiritual practice. I wasn't looking for a way to discriminate with accuracy the nature of love. But that's essentially what I found. That's essentially what I was given. That's essentially what I cultivated when I came to spiritual practice. Hello. Come on in. So what I want to suggest to you to start with is that the ideas that we come to relationship with are often completely misleading. That is, the nature of love is described in books and songs. It is extolled by authorities of all stripes in certain terms, and yet those terms seem not to hold water, seem not to be real, to have something genuine for us, nourishing for us, something that lasts. Surely, if love is anything, it is not as ephemeral as a flower in one sense. It may manifest as the ephemerality of a human life. So, for example, I still feel the love of my mother, who's been dead 11 and a half years. Or I feel the love of my teacher, who's been dead about 11 years. But those are like flowers, and yet those flowers do not wither, or the effect of those flowers in my heart do not wither. So what's the distinction between that and these other forms of love? Purported love. Love does not take, or does not only take. Love gives. That's a working proposition here for our consideration. And yet, when we hear love described, we hear, "She done me wrong." Or we hear about what we want from the other person, the object of our love, what we seek to obtain from them, whether it's really hot sex, or it's companionship, acceptance, a sugar daddy, lots of things, lots of possibilities. And we think that we know what not to look for. We think we know that No, I can grasp that generosity is the foundation of love. That makes sense to me. And yet, we find ourselves actually acting in a way which is not congruent with that insight. So, love is more than just an idea. Love is not simply an emotional reaction. I see someone attractive to me, I go, oh, yeah, I want some of that. That's not love. It's not necessarily incompatible with love, but neither is it giving. Neither is it understanding what this is, this being me, and what me might be, what I might become. So the first thing about love, then, is to learn to be honest with ourselves, to be genuine, and to not disrespect ourselves by lying to ourselves about our own impulses. Of course I see someone attractive and I want contact. But that's not love. Of course a parent feels impelled to care for a child. And yet sometimes so-called parental love turns into parents living vicariously through their children, forcing them into certain roles unconsciously. I'm not talking about consciously. I'm not talking about the more obvious examples that we could cite along these lines. I'm talking about something that is to ourselves very subtle, because we're so good at selling ourselves a bill of goods about our generosity, about our clarity, about who we would wish ourselves to be seen as, both internally and externally. So, I don't doubt that that lady in Walnut Creek or wherever it was, who sadly killed herself and her son, believed she loved her son. And I'm not even willing to say that she didn't actually have some love for him, for this offspring of her loins. Yet, clearly, there was a disconnect. Clearly, there was such a profound level of illusion that she missed something really, really important. And that's what spiritual practice is about. It's about seeing those things about ourselves that are only visible when we direct objective attention onto our behavior. When we look at ourselves as if we were a Martian looking at the behavior of this little ant crawling on the surface of planet Earth, and can evaluate and look at that with clarity, because that's the only way we're going to get clarity about the stuff that's so problematic, the stuff that we can so readily lie to ourselves about. So that's the first thing I want to offer for your consideration. That's why I said at the beginning, I don't bring good news. Because who the heck wants to look at themselves? Really? Who really wants to look at themselves? It is not a common ambition. It is quite uncommon ambition. And even those who end up doing self-study of through meditative techniques and whatnot for many years may completely miss the absolutely crucial, obvious things, the nose on their faces, because it's so easy to lie to yourself. So, not good news to start, apparently. Maybe I should break here for questions and comments before I go on. Or is it all too just too depressing? A dose of reality here in happy Sebastopol.
Rob, it seems as if you've been talking about romantic love. Is that the correct assumption?
I've been focusing, I would say, on romantic love mostly, but not only. I deliberately brought in parental love as well. Mm-hmm. So you could genuinely say that I'm looking at what you might call the ordinary levels of human love. Mm-hmm. You know, the levels that are extolled and lionized.
A personal
level of love. We haven't even gotten to, although I hope to get to address the subject of more exalted forms of love. But the reason I started where I started is precisely that if we can't be honest with ourselves about these mundane aspects of love, then there's no way we're going to be able to, you know, we'll have a clue about being able to make the extremely fine discernments necessary to see what's happening with divine love or love for the divine. I was just reading a lovely essay recently. And the point of this essay is that, excuse me, the argument of the essay is that we, with divine love, we seek to be one with God, but then God ejects us like a seed or a pip out of some fruit, because that's the only way that we can then return the favor. That's the only way we can love God. We achieve union with God and then are ejected deliberately in order to be able to offer the service of love for God. But my gosh, how the heck are we going to know anything about that if we can't even have clarity about doing the hoochie coochie on the sheets with somebody?
Well, I think the former is much easier than the latter.
The former is much easier than the latter?
I think it's much easier to have clarity about divine love than it is about intense personal love, because the blood flow to the brain, for one thing, really gets cut down on the neurocortex.
It's for guys, at least.
For women as well. The ability to think with our logical faculties actually is severely diminished in high emotional states.
I got that. I would, for the most part, agree with that, with that formulation. Although I'm not so sanguine about, or not so willing to go along entirely with the assertion that the divine love is actually easier. But I understand the point you're making. And I think what I would say is that it's easier to think about divine love, but it's not easier to experience actual opening of being to that level of reality. So there's a balance point there. You know, one of the things that about love, whether divine or human, is that we tend to do it because of our training, because of the way people grow up in our culture, we tend to do it in an unbalanced way. That is, the whole organism doesn't participate for the most part. And you get all this internal disagreement, even about the object of love. Sometimes, even when you're in the midst of puppy love, although puppy love or an intense erotic attachment can do a pretty good job of blinding one to the impulses arising from these other centers, but eventually they do reassert themselves. And I want to suggest that there's a similar process that happens with divine love. That if divine love is not a piece of the entirety, is not created as a product of cooperation throughout the organism, a cooperation, a synergy that does not arise naturally for the most part, then the divine love is going to be just as ineffectual as the human love. Ineffectual in the sense of, how can I create something sustaining? How can I create something that has both a solid foundation, strong roots, a strong trunk, and beautiful branches, leaves, and flowers that gives to the universe. So that's both human love and divine love, in my view. That's both of them. But I really appreciate your question because I think it's worth comparing the two, and we might as well do it early on rather than later on. Yeah.
Is there something? I was just still thinking about that woman who killed that murder suicide in the East Bay. But you were talking about divine love, and I was thinking, isn't there some pain involved with love?
Sure.
And so that's kind of we say abnormal what happened there in the East Bay.
Well, it's certainly regrettable, that's for sure.
Yeah, and probably...
Thank goodness it's abnormal.
Yeah. But what if she was so in love with her son that, I mean, what I'm trying to say is sort of twisted, something really twisted there about love. And I don't go off on that. More on, it's kind of pain. It's sort of like John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, you know, that kind of dark night of the soul. And I think Mother Teresa said she had 2 years of dark night of the soul where she didn't feel connection with God, even though she was so altruistic, where she lost her sense of herself in her giving. I'm just curious about pain and love and that kind of.
Thank you. It's a good question. The word that I would tend to use is suffering, and in our tradition there's something that we call voluntary suffering, and voluntary suffering is something that one undertakes for specific reasons. It's one of the ways that we can actually test, for example, human love. If we're actually willing to sacrifice our own selfish interests for the betterment of the object of our love, then that's actually a pretty good test. It's a pretty good cultivation, actually, to as well create that unity that I was talking about, where you don't have these impulses arising in the body, taking you in one direction, in the mind, taking you in still another direction, and with the emotional reactivity to small and great things, taking you in a plethora of directions. So suffering, intentional suffering, voluntary suffering, can be a way to pull together these disparate impulses in a direction that creates a kind of unity which may make it possible for there to be some kind of lasting quality to the relationship.
A test
of oneself. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of like forging metal in a fire. Some things you have to heat them up in order to bring out the properties that are inherent in the substance, but without the heat would not manifest, would not be created. So suffering is a way to establish that kind of thing. It's a way to check.
So it's kind of like good pain.
it's pain is pain. Let's call a spade a spade here. Pain is pain, but it's pain that has a purpose of service. And the service is not really so much to ourselves, but it's service to something greater than ourselves. So on the human realm, it might be our children, or it might be a lover, a spouse, or maybe more. But the same principle applies, I'll suggest, when we're attempting to cultivate something approaching divine love as well. You got a question here?
As to the woman in the East Bay,
mm-hmm.
if you can put qualifiers on love, I would say there's such a thing as selfish love and selfless love, and I have no doubt that she loved her son, but in such a selfish way that she didn't want to leave him behind. She wanted to take him with her. Mm-hmm. She didn't want him to be on the earth without her, which is it. It is a real corruption of love.
Right.
But
maybe she meant to protect him.
Well, maybe so. Maybe she thought he would not be. I didn't read the circumstances, whether he was able-bodied or maybe mentally.
No, I think he was fine.
Perfectly normal. As far as anyone knew.
Yeah. No. I think there had been a divorce. That's all I know. And I think there was something about that.
There are other elements in there.
Yeah.
So. Punishment.
Well, I think your basic point, though, about so-called selfish versus selfless is pointing us in an important direction, though, here. Because the qualities of love that are illusory, that I was referring to earlier when I first started speaking, are ones that I think you could easily lump together under that rubric of selfish love. Love that seeks to take in, as opposed to be selfless, which is in one sense a deconstruction of what we have taken to be the identity of the self. So selflessness is a means of taking parts of what we thought was the self and giving it away. And that is painful. That is suffering. That is not an easy thing to do, for the most part. I'm not saying that it's 100%. I'm not saying it's 100% torture. But the way that our consciousness and the organism is constructed makes that an act that goes against the grain in some very real ways. And that's why selflessness is not so easy to achieve. Michael, did you have a comment?
Well, I'm looking at the issue of selfless and selfish right now. Selfish is not love.
Right.
And the wonderful thing about the dynamic of love is that in giving, you receive without without thinking about the receiving, but it just kind of happens. And so it becomes a kind of a sustainable arrangement, because you're giving and giving and you're not being depleted somehow. You're just not, but you're being increased mm-hmm. by that very thing that you're giving away.
If I agree with you, if you're doing it right, it's possible to do. It's possible to do that in a way that is not healthy.
Oh.
So it's tricky. This is a tricky area.
Profit. the original question I want to ask you had to do with you were saying that we don't want to see ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if.
Or it's difficult to be willing to see yourself.
But I was wondering if there isn't a hidden impulse or need or even hunger to see ourselves, even in contradiction to this terrorism of seeing ourselves at certain times when we're not really ready to love.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to know that. We need to find that out. And somewhere inside we know that if we don't, then there's no hope. We'll never learn how to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think there is a hidden impulse or desire to see ourselves.
I don't disagree with that at all. In fact, I think that's why most people come to spiritual practice. That's one of the reasons why people seek to come together in ways that do manifest, at least to some extent, selflessly, as opposed to just selfishly. You know, there's another whole level here. It's not just selfish and selfless. There's also just the sort of mechanical sustaining of human life in association with other human beings. You know, we create ourselves through our relationships with other human beings at the most basic level, you know, even physiologically. You know, I'm fond of, there's a certain book here in the store called A General Theory of Love, which is a lovely description of how, on a physiological level, babies have proximity to the bodies, not just of mothers, but mothers and fathers and other caregivers, etc., family, friends, because their bodies learn physiologically how to breathe, how to set up rhythms that sustain, physiological rhythms that will sustain the body. And even when we come to adulthood, that need to have contact with other bodies is not entirely atrophied or diminished. It still arises, such that we see the research which asserts that, you know, when people have a productive and healthy social life, they're far more likely to live longer and be healthier physically, as opposed to people who are very socially isolated. So it's also true that we constitute ourselves emotionally through our interaction with others as well. So that we are in fact mammals, and we take our cues from our fellow mammals to a greater or lesser extent. It's not just as simple as the idea that we are herd animals, but we are troop animals. We are primate troop animals, in profound ways, and those things are sort of tangential to the debate of selfish versus selfless. But if we don't recognize those actual needs, then we can get confused about what's appropriate and what's inappropriate. You know, some people extol going into the forest and seeking to live the life of a hermit. And it might be true that for a few people that's going to be a productive direction, actually, to cultivate love, because that might be a context where they could isolate, in isolation, that is to say, they might be able to find some of the internal levers that govern the arising of some of these selfish versus selfless impulses. But the fact is that most of us are not going to go out and live in the forest. We're not going to isolate ourselves in caves or monasteries. So we want to find ways where we can get this information, where we can, and this is information that we create ourselves through the practice of being honest with ourselves. Yeah.
I'm sorry, humanly, so I don't know if you spoke about that, but mm-hmm. You're talking about selfishness versus selflessness.
Right.
And I've been really wanting some kind of operational definition of the two, because we're pretty quick to figure out as humans that it's not cool to be selfish. Mm-hmm. So for selfish purposes, you might want to appear selfless.
Right.
Even to yourself.
Absolutely. In fact, that is something of what I was talking about at the very beginning. But I'm happy. This is something that bears repeating.
Yeah, I'm seeing like signs of narcissism happening in people that are talking about their spiritual growth and their expansion into enlightenment and selflessness, and they're like, they got all this paraphernalia and pictures of themselves and yoga positions and talking about, you know, transcending all material goods except for
everything that they want.
Yeah, and all the things they want. So I'm really wanting some kind of a practical way to distinguish the two, not out of any sort of meanness, but even just within myself to know where I'm coming from.
Got that. I wish I could give you a 25 words or less meaningful response, but the basic response that I have is that when you band together with people who have the same goal, that is to be ruthlessly honest with one another and with themselves, number one, that's your best chance. Because most people don't have that explicit goal. And it helps to have that explicit goal present. You know, the Buddha was very clear that hanging out with people who have an interest in meditation, who like to talk about meditation and the products of meditation, who want to understand the places that meditation can take you, that self-examination can take you, will be far more productive than hanging out with people who have an anti-interest in those things and those products. So my basic response is that find people who are insistent that this is the most important thing. It's the place to start. If we're going to find love, then we need to first distinguish what is not love. And let me tell you, that can be a darn painful thing to look at, as you yourself are implying very, very astutely, I think. These impulses in ourselves to make ourselves look good in very sophisticated ways, are the death knell of the honesty that is necessary to create this kind of effect. So getting real with love requires first acknowledging what love is not. Love is not me telling myself, I love you, I love you, I love you. I love me, I love me, I love me. I love my partner, I love my partner, I love my partner. I love my parents, I love my parents, I love my parents. One of the surest signs of self-deception is when you have to keep repeating, a voice has to keep repeating itself in your head to convince you that something is true. You know, that's what people who are trying to maintain any kind of ideology, a commitment to any kind of ideology in their heads, are constantly doing. They're constantly reinforcing that kind of self-flagellation. And it means nothing in reality, except that it uses up a lot of energy. It takes up a lot of your mental CD-ROM, your emotional CD-ROM, and you have very little to show for it when you do a reboot at the end of this life. So what I'm suggesting is that we devote resources to the project of actually being honest with ourselves. And in fact, love is the place where you're going to get the most bang for your buck in terms of this sort of self-examination. Because that's where the pedal hits the metal for most of us, most intensely, most productively. So thank you for the question. It's a very good question. I wish I had the 25 words or less answer, because then I'd be not only rich, but deservedly rich.
Like a four word one. Trust your bullshit detector.
That's not bad, except I don't even trust my bullshit detector.
You can do yourself.
Exactly right. I mean, basically, there is a practice whereby we never rest on our laurels, even when we've seen a profound insight. A profound insight about our own level of dishonesty about something. In the next moment, the mind can start spinning yet another web that incorporates that wonderful insight into it, builds up a beautiful story about how now it's all fine. Mm-hmm. Now it's wonderful. Now I've got it. Now I am a selfless, enlightened being, full of love, and able to share my beauty with the rest of creation. Sharing your beauty with the rest of creation entails, as this gentleman suggested earlier, actually being willing to go to a place of suffering. Because suffering is really intentional suffering about honesty. That is to say, being willing to acknowledge that, yes, I have been an asshole. Yes, I have been stupid. Yes, I have been incredibly manipulative. And successfully so, by the world's standards, at times, is an absolute prerequisite. So I start with Carl, and I keep going. Because this is an engagement that gets better the more intensely you follow it out, and more satisfying. There is something really wonderful about acquiring a certain kind of sensitivity to one's own self-deception. My teacher used to call it a certain slippery something. And when you get the scent of it, you know, like a predator. But you're a predator of your own, the spore of lies that you leave behind you as you go through your internal life, moment by moment. And that pain of acknowledgement also is a cleansing. It's a cleansing that leaves us empty in a way that feels lovely, appropriate, and beautiful. It's not a lonely emptiness. It's a generous emptiness. You had a...
Oh, I was just going to say, I was kind of following the riff there, and I was kind of the word I was trying to put, I think, is certain kind of humility in a real, true sense. I've been watching the Pledge Week on PBS, and they have a lot of, various kinds of gurus and pop gurus, kubas, and there was Wayne Dyer talking the other night. I've watched him over the years, and it just changes kind of with the times, and he's getting older. and I just, my bullshit meter is just keeps going on. Come on, feeling my gut reaction is just bullshit. The other thing I wanted to say about self-examination, I think, is so important to any organization. Because I used to be part of Cinema back in the 60s.
Uh-huh.
And great, they're very successful and all that. But they never examined their power structure and that they say power corrupts and absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. It was kind of fascistic.
Right.
But that's, in hindsight, it had become that. And real sort of narcissistic too, because the hierarchy believed their own stuff, and everybody else believed it.
That's the problem.
Yeah. So that's a sort of a distrust. It's always good to question. At least I have found the people who say they're gurus or put up as gurus, basically.
Thank you. That's actually an important point, especially this last point brings up something important, which to me is spiritual teachers are people who in general will be the ones who are claiming to be able to lead you or help you, assist you in wading through your own bullshit. But what's so crucial to look at in any teacher is, does he or she isolate him or herself from criticism? My favorite teachers are ones that are constantly going and chatting with people from different traditions, from different entirely people with entirely different premises than their own basic beliefs or basic directions, and rubbing up against them and seeing what happens, as opposed to when you find people who isolate themselves at the center of a group that it just becomes yes women and yes men. And then that's a pretty obvious one, and the problem is that most big organizations, spiritual, religious, most religious hierarchies, how could you define them other than that? They're people who have jobs, and they achieve their jobs by impressing power-possessing beings in the organization, and there you go. Money and power are the enemies of the truth, and have been throughout human history. So that's the problem with religious hierarchies. We make a distinction between spiritual and religious, and the distinction we make is that a religion is basically a spiritual tradition whose followers have lost the thread. Let's assume that at the beginning there was a founder or even a group who had genuine insight, who had not just genuine insight, but genuine practices that could lead others to insight. But if those are not embodied in the lives of the people who come after, then what you get, or not fully embodied, even if there's a lot of embodiment, but not the full clarity that the founders had, then what you get is an institution, a human institution, which begins inevitably to take on the flaws and faults of all human institutions that whose basic agenda is to preserve and protect power and money. So it's a very dangerous thing when religious or spiritual organizations become very rich or powerful. It was certainly not a good thing, in my opinion, for Christianity to become a state religion. My goodness. But you could argue that the Jews had been lost well before that.
So there seems to be a point where original inspiration turns into principles and beliefs. It turns into a program. Mm-hmm. So it loses its spontaneity. It loses its its contact with its own origin, and that's one of my tests. It has to do with spontaneity. Mm-hmm. And the discovery and the rediscovery and the rediscovery of that same principle in the moment. But even if you're saying it like the 100 millionth time, it's like you're still discovering it for the first time in the moment. And so there's just this sense of realness. Mm-hmm. That you feel.
Yeah, and that's a personal thing. That occurs to individual human beings at individual moments, and sometimes it occurs in the context of what we would call love, just to pull us back to our topic here. Sometimes it occurs in the context of physical love, of the pleasurable rubbing of bodies together. The pleasurable rubbing of bodies together is something that all mammals do. But for us human beings, there are all these ways that we can fool ourselves about what the implications of that rubbing together might be. And fool the other person to get them to keep doing what we want or to stop doing what we don't want, and vice versa. So that's where what can be the source of spontaneity, even physical love, can become routinized at first subtly, and eventually, not so subtly at all, really a deadening sort of mechanical process whereby a certain kind of release is achieved, maybe, or maybe not, but has nothing to do with that quality of exploration that enables the arising or is produced by and through the arising of spontaneity. Of spontaneous self-exploration, mutual self-exploration. That's what we human beings can do in a way that other creatures that we know of, for the most part, can't. We have the potential to engage in this incredible act of sharing the most intimate part of ourselves with another person. Not just physical rubbing, but emotional rubbing and intellectual rubbing together, all in one, which can have incredible products in our lives. But it is so delicate. It is so subtle. It is so easily subsumed within the self-deception and lies that are so easily generated in the attempt to continue to have these experiences, in the attempt to create conditions where, oh, this feels so good, I want more. Mm-hmm. You know? And what happens? We kill it. Without meaning to. Without meaning to kill it, we kill it. Yeah.
There's a Toyota commercial, I love what you do for me. So much of what passes for love is exactly that. It's what you're getting.
That's exactly right.
And maybe you're getting the way the person sees you as a lovely image of yourself that you want to preserve, but that is not love.
Oh, you like my thighs? Mm.
Tell me they're beautiful. Good for you.
Exactly. Exactly. Tell me more. But it, I mean, the levels of self-deception become very, very convoluted, subtle and convoluted, very, 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 very quickly. And without our really seeing it, unless we've established a habit of self-examination that can sustain itself productively, even in the midst of the arising of these incredibly subtle, and sometimes not so subtle, impulses and conditions. So that's what spiritual practice, as I understand it, is about. It's the creation of habit conditions in your consciousness which open you to being able to see on the fly, in the moment, the arising of these opportunities to lie to yourself, these opportunities for self-deception, these opportunities to use another person to lie to yourself. That's in some ways the most horrific lie about, quote, love, unquote, that we hear and see, is how we use other people to create a comfortable image of ourselves, a false but comforting image of ourselves. And I have seen in myself, and I have seen in others, the depths to which we'll go sometimes in service of that. So to disconnect that habit is not a simple or straightforward matter. It cannot be done, for the most part, directly. You can't just, you know, oh, I just saw that, and you reach in and turn the wrench and everything's fine. It's so complicated that if you pull one thing and you're going to affect 10 other things, and you may screw things up far worse than you realized. So the practice is to begin to simply be aware, moment by moment, of what's arising with regard to these products of love, so-called love, these strategies to generate conditions whereby that which we found really appealing and delightful can be continued. There's in Faust, there's this, by Goethe, there's this famous line, Verweile doch, du bist so schön. It means, linger a while, you are so beautiful, referring to this moment when life has achieved this limpid perfection. So gorgeous, so wonderful. And our problem is that we have such low standards. We're willing to say that at the drop of a hat. At least Faust did it in the story. He said that line, finally, when he had achieved the generosity of heart to be able to give consistently, not just to one or two people, but to thousands of people. To be big-hearted enough to have that level of love to say, this is enough. This is enough for me, yes. Linger a while. You're so beautiful. So, you know, the devil comes to take him, drag him away, because that's the deal. As soon as he utters that line, you know, he's out of here. But because he has done it in this spirit, at this moment of supreme service, God comes and saves him. And that's the line we walk as we try to find the truth moment by moment in this tissue of self-deception and lies and the cobwebs of the past pulling at us, tugging at us. When we find our way through that to that jewel of dew hanging on the cobweb and see in that reflected everything, every moment of connection we've ever felt, well, there's an achievement worth lingering over. But that's why I said at the beginning that this project of getting real about love can seem like a real bummer at the start, because my gosh, it's, you know, it sucks that I'm selfish. It sucks that I'm full of selfish, stupid impulses. Stupid in the sense that I don't see what will actually bring me happiness, which is giving happiness to others. Giving away my own happiness to others, which the universe has to replenish. That's the trick. If you are continually emptying the generosity in your heart and giving it away, it has to get refilled. And if you don't take false coin for that, if you insist on leaving yourself empty in the right way, then the universe will give you something extraordinary.
Yeah, something just coming up for me in relation to the question of how you distinguish unselfish love from selfish love. And what comes up is that unselfish love or an unselfish loving act is something for which you do neither accept nor receive or seek credit. And the challenge with that is that when I look at acts of quote-unquote generosity and can see kind of a haze of agenda there, sometimes I find that those parts of myself have little interest in doing something for someone that I won't receive credit or will not be seen.
Right.
And spiritual practices often have these acts of anonymous giving, anonymous actions, just as a way to demonstrate to ourselves, to test to ourselves, and to gain experience of what a truly unselfish act is, such that we have a benchmark to compare that to the acts that go by the ordinary definition of love.
Thank you. I hardly have anything to add to that.
Sort of like a random act of kindness. Yeah. Sort of a drive-by kind of kindness.
Yeah, but the minute you put the bumper sticker on your car, you're doing anything.
No, it's supposed to be on your heart, on your bumper sticker.
That's right. But that's actually, that gets back to the point that came up earlier, your point earlier about pain, or as I change it, to suffering. It is suffering to do something generous for someone without the prospect of anyone ever knowing about it.
Why is that suffering?
Why is that suffering?
I disagree.
Good. Then tell me why.
That is joy. because I've done it. It gives me a great joy.
Well, then you have cultivated something smart in you. That's my point. If you can create a part of yourself that can do that and see that effect, which is one of the cultivations that I've been talking about tonight, then in fact you are speaking about one of the ways in which we create this habit of seeing where the joy really lies, seeing where the suffering really lies. The suffering is in the grasping and the manipulation. We don't feel good when we manipulate people. It hurts. It actually hurts. It's incredibly painful. So you're spot on, of course, as usual, in this point, because that's where we need to go. And we need to go there in ways that are generous with our bodies, our hearts, and our minds, and maybe even eventually even more, so that we can, you know, if it's possible to be anonymous in service of God, even, that would be a pretty cool trick.
I think Jesus said, you know, when you give, don't stand on the corner where everyone can see and give alms.
That's right.
You do it so your right hand, your left hand doesn't know what your right is doing.
That's right.
Just do
That's
it in
right.
secret, and your Father who sees it in secret will reward you openly.
That's right.
But it's always been that, just that you don't go after
that means
something coming back. You do it because you do it. You do it out of love. You do it out of, you could say, service to something else, or you just do it because you do it.
That's right. But that is a cultivation that that means that we give up the usual commitment of the agendas that we carry around and are trying to enact in the way that this gentleman over here was talking about earlier. You know, these agendas which seek to aggrandize myself, to make myself bigger in a stupid way. In a way that does not understand how the process works.
Yeah, it's just not effective.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's not effective, and so it's selfish and stupid. But it's common. It's what, God knows, it's what I have started out doing. And it took an incredibly powerful spiritual teacher banging his head against mine again and again and again for me to start to realize that, oh my God, yeah, I've been an idiot about this. I have been an idiot about this. It's not easy to see that. Some people have an easier time. Some people have a harder time. I'm one of the idiots. You know, I needed really powerful impressions to switch around.
Can you speak a little about what are causes? What is it about culture, the way we're raised, that brings about this stupidity or this mistake, especially when we're raising our children and we're thinking like, well, we'd like for them to be smart about it and realize that the more they give, the more they love others, the more fulfilled they are. And
right.
Just receiving love from others is actually a kind of empty thing. So what do we do as parents to foster that?
The key thing is always demonstration. We say in our tradition, we say the being that is the core essence of who we are always learns by demonstration. The surface mind, sometimes you might call the ego, learns through words, and that's the tissue of lies that we have to eventually learn how to part like the Red Sea. And it's the demonstration of honesty, of clarity, that will have the effect on children and on adults that we would most wish to have them receive and understand. But that means that we ourselves have to be able to offer that demonstration and perhaps put our children in the company of others who we think will also be able to help give that demonstration, give those sorts of demonstrations. You know, and when I say demonstrations, I mean real demonstrations. There's this lovely story of an 8-year-old American kid goes to with his parents to Tibet, and they go to a monastery, and there's this little 5-year-old Tibetan boy, and they're sort of interacting because he's the closest in age to this American kid, and the American kid is sort of acting like an obnoxious, you know, attention deprived typical American kid, and finally, you know, hits this little much smaller kid and is crying in shame and frustration because this kid is just not going along with the program. And the little 5-year-old Tibetan boy comforts the older child, you know, and tells him it'll be okay. That's a demonstration of love, of generosity. But it's not the sort of demonstration you're going to find necessarily on every street corner. Although some street corners you will. You have to be sensitive to, you have to be paying attention. And you have to when you find someone like that, my gosh, I practically leap on them. You know, because those are special people. Those are the ones you want to hang out with. Those are the ones that are like gold. They can dispense gold. Yeah.
Something in me tells me that part of that is love when you're able to identify someone who's already there. But mm-hmm. for me, like the most challenge I get is being able to see that in people who don't show it outwardly, like see that potential.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out like how to be loving around people who aren't loving in the same way that is such demonstrated. Do you have any like insight about how to cultivate that and mm-hmm. and help create it in people who are not even thinking on that in that regard yet?
That's a really good question. I think that you're the first person who's ever asked me that question. Thank you. I'll just say that this point of that you know Stuart made earlier about and that we've been talking about anonymity is not, that is to say, not seeking credit for good works, for that kind of demonstration. That's the sort of person that you want to have your radar, you know, set for. And so the way that I do it is to pay attention to the smallest details of how they interact with people. In the Gurdjieff tradition, from which our Tayu tradition derives, there's this sense of the importance of little things like hospitality. So, you know, when people are treated as honored guests who come to your, you know, you go to their house, and in small ways, not ostentatious ways, but in small ways, people are made to feel at ease, made to feel comfortable, made to feel honored. That's something that I would look for. And people do that in their homes and elsewhere too. And so opening your heart to seeing those small things is the way to find it seems to me, or that's one good way to look for this kind of person who acts anonymously in generosity towards others. Because they're not looking for, they're expressly not looking for the outer credit. In fact, they're trying to avoid it.
Go ahead. What about the people where you don't even see those little things present?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like if all of the loving, like outwardly and even like with small intentions and actions, if all of those loving people form their own community, like mm-hmm. that would be kind of like the utopia. But then all of the people that have been left behind wouldn't have any kind of model or demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. To kind of fit in, so like the community has to be open and welcome into welcoming people who don't identify and are not the same thing.
Precisely.
How can that be manifested properly?
Got that. Well, that's another excellent question. The traditional way in our tradition and the sheaf of traditions of which we would be consider ourselves a part, is to have what's called a spiritual school. And a spiritual school is something that is both of the world, but not owned by the world. So we try to cultivate the kind of honesty about love and our own agendas, selfish agendas, that seek to use love as a screen, or the idea of love as a screen, both within and among ourselves, but also through our interaction with people in everyday life. So how do you determine, how do you find those people? You open your heart and are honest with yourself about how you feel around certain people versus other people. Do you feel a kind of lightness of heart and generosity of spirit when you hang out with some people? And do you feel, I don't know, a sort of heaviness in contrast to others? By their fruit ye shall know them, the Bible says. And that's as good a, you know, as good a directive as I know how to do.
What do you do with the people you feel heavy around?
Love them as much as I can. Give them as much honesty as they're willing to hear, and any other assistance that they may allow to come into their lives, which varies from time to time, from moment to moment. You know, people are you know, our lives are mechanical in so many ways. They're the product of mechanical reactivities to causes and conditions, internal and external. But sometimes, you know, the stars align, and you know, and somebody who seems very unhappy can suddenly have a moment of openness, of open-heartedness, where they can actually receive a genuine loving impression and be touched by it. So that's one of the reasons why a spiritual practice like ours emphasizes putting attention moment by moment on everything that you're doing, because it's only then that you can take advantage of that moment and offer that flower of honesty, like the Buddha offered his flower to one of his first disciples. And that was the moment, that was the act that enlightened that disciple. Well, we want to be able to offer our smaller flowers as best we can in those unique and rare moments as they arise. But the only way we can do that is by cultivating honesty about with ourselves, about our own agendas. If we're lost in some fog of self-deception about who I am and who I'd like to be perceived as, then we'll miss it. We'll miss those rare moments. And that's you know, that's a shame when that happens. So, you know, I do my best to try to be on top of things, to be able to catch those beautiful, beautiful moments. That's it for Weile doch, du bist so schön moment. Linger a while, you're so beautiful. Of course, they don't linger. But actually, the proffering of the flower in demonstration, metaphorically speaking, is a way to help that happen as much as possible. And being honest about your own mistakes in love is the surest way to find the sensitivity in yourself to notice those moments when they arise. Because when we have a shield, a knock-knock invisible shield against letting anybody else see that about ourselves, then we're not going to be able to see through that shield ourselves to the other people around us. So thank you for the questions. Good ones.
Well, I had one more question.
Yeah.
You were mentioning to this lady about there's kind of some kind of suffering in giving anonymously. Is that what I heard you say?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Hey, could you work on that one a little bit?
Right. I'm saying that the ordinary selfish consciousness, the ordinary level of selfish consciousness, always is looking for is looking at our place in the primate hierarchy. Basically, we're monkeys, and most of the time, to a far greater extent than we realize, we are looking for opportunities to reify or change our position in the social hierarchy that we understand, that our minds project onto our fellows. And so giving that up is what I was calling smart. And it's not generally something that we start off being able to do, unless we're 5-year-old Tibetan boys in a monastery, apparently. And maybe even he didn't start off being able to do it, or maybe he did. Maybe he's a reincarnation that could do something like that. I certainly can't exclude that possibility.
So where's the suffering in giving anonymously? I'm just might be dense.
It's just that you're not getting credit. Okay, so if you're not getting credit, then you're just giving something away for no reason.
Right. No interest on it.
Right. No. That's right.
Right.
It's a no interest loan.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's a no interest gift. Mm-hmm. And
it's not Valentine's Day or Mother's Day.
It's not Valentine's Day or Mother's Day. There's no response. There's no expected response from the universe that will validate you for having done that. And that's what I'm saying.
So it's
is
not
suffering.
An obligation, and it's not an ego thing of gaining status or putting your name on a building in a university or something.
Well, that's why it's suffering, because you're giving up that impulse to seek, the reward. Exactly. Thank you. The reward is so important. The reward, you know, we want to be Boy Scouts and help Granny across the street, mm-hmm. but we really don't want to do it for the most part.
Sure.
Without other people seeing that we're being so noble,
right.
You know, and because that affects how we see ourselves in regard to the hierarchy.
And if we do it to feel good that we're mm-hmm. doing it, is that narcissistic, would you say?
It can be. If you're doing it to reify these internal voices, to give them more, oh man, that was so fantastic.
No, just doing it because, oh, that makes me feel good, and I must be good if I'm doing it. Is that twisted? Is that kind of perverse?
That you're getting into an area where there's a lot of self-deception possible, mm-hmm. basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so the purest manifestation of it is the manifestation where I literally don't think about it. I literally do not think about it. I simply do the act.
But if it gives you joy.
There's no problem with
self-deception.
There's no problem with joy. If you get joy, that's fine. But if you do it in anticipation of joy, that's still an agenda. Okay? That's still an agenda. It's not that that's bad. It's just not quite as clean as doing it. You know, the Bhagavad Gita, you know, extols this idea that we act without regard for the consequences of our act. We act appropriately, even realizing that we may never receive credit for it, that we may never have the desired effect of actually helping someone else. The problem with having an agenda about helping other people is that there is a grasping element to it if we're seeking to make ourselves feel better as we do it. And that actually takes some of the energy back from the act that we could be giving, that we could be offering in service through the extension of the generosity. So it's not that it's all bad or all good. It's that it's slightly tainted compared to the purity of simply giving without object. Yeah.
So the classic case in the Bible of Solomon's trial, with the women arguing whose child it is, and his solution was, well, we're just going to cut it in half and have, you know, equal right. opportunities for both. So the one that says, sure, sounds good, and is was clearly not the mother, and the one that says, no, give the child to her, is the mother.
Right.
So what I found in myself is that I'm truly giving when I'm happier, when I found out, oh, I actually don't need to give anything. Actually someone else is taking care of it. I don't need to do it. So, like, I've had the case where, you know, I pull over on the side of the road and someone has a broken down car and I go to help them. I get the whole, like, I can't believe you're an angel. Where did you come from? You know, all this. But when, if I am happy to find out that actually the car is fine and they don't really need my help, then I'm truly coming to help the person. But if I'm kind of disappointed that I didn't get to be a hero, then I'm not.
Right.
Then I'm coming from myself. So
right.
I think that's where I use that distinction within myself.
Thank you. I think that's very clear.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. It's like if there's no agenda to be perceived as good even by your own ego, then it's as pure as you're going to get as an act of service. But even some small bit of that will be you know, less than optimal.
Do you think that's where confusion with romantic love can come in? Where people get very, like, set on this one person that they are in love with and then want to be that person that gives the person love.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of seeing that maybe they are already loving and being loved by somebody else or by the community, anonymity play into that, do you think?
Yeah, that's getting into the very complicated agendas that get established in this whole arena of romantic and interpersonal relationship. And believe it or not, it is possible to come to relationship without having to seek to find in another person something lacking in yourself. But I think most people come to relationship with either an unconscious sense of needing to find completion and seeking that in another person, or and complementarily offering that to the other person. And it's not that there's anything wrong with that. It's not, that's not a bad thing. But love, that one puts love in a kind of box or egg or some kind of shell. Whereas the love that I can bring to another person and give without having a necessary aspect of reciprocation from that other person is love that can move through that person and move beyond that person. Touch others as well. And when two people are doing that, my gosh, those are those beautiful marriages or comings together that you know ennoble everybody around. It's a rare thing, and most of us, you know, necessarily come to these things from a greater or lesser degree of feeling incomplete about ourselves. But that's the other part of spiritual practice, is seeking to discover that full sense of being full without needing to seek completion in another, that then allows for that to arise. But mostly that's fairly rare. That's pretty rare. And relationship in the work, in that is the capital W work, in spiritual practice work, is where people come together in a way such that they are being honest about these qualities in themselves, to themselves and to their partner, with the object of eventually no longer having to manipulate the other person to fulfill the expectations that we, you know, generally speaking, long to see fulfilled in the object, in that object of love. So it gets complicated. Thank you. Other comments, questions, observations? We're getting a little late here.
A star has no thought of giving light. It's just burning. It's just burning itself.
Right.
And it's a very, it's spontaneous. That's kind of like, it's kind of like my model.
Got that. Well, I don't have a problem with that model, except we are potentially stars that can irradiate in many different spectra. How would that be? In other words, there are many ways that we can give, and the modulation of those acts of generosity is kind of the point. In other words, I don't want to give mechanically. I want to give in the way that we were talking about earlier, so that I'm conscious and aware and can see just where to shine what I have to offer at just the moment that it will do the work that will most generously serve that other person.
You don't think the star is conscious?
Well, yes, but maybe not in the way that you can be, or I can be, or any of us here can be, through a process of self-examination. I'm not saying it's not true. I don't know. I literally don't know. And I wouldn't also go so far as to say that there are not other beings or energies in the universe that don't partake of the kind of self-examination process that I'm pointing to. But the reason I'm making the distinction here is because it's easy to say I just want to radiate. But it's much harder to say, I want to learn consciously to generously radiate. Because that takes us to this process of self-examination, which is not simply a process of lighting your hydrogen and getting some helium at the end.
This self-examining is a part of the shining, because it is, love is really, really, it's a simple act, and mm-hmm. and in order to find that simplicity, you have to work your way through all of the complications.
Well, we don't disagree there. No, we don't disagree there.
You can't deny the complications that are involved. But when you're dealing with those complications just right, you just feel this shining.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're following this. It's like you're following this story.
That
you don't plan on reaching.
Okay, I don't have a problem with that. My comment to that is that that's fine, but there's a missing step that we almost always, our minds almost always elide, the step over, avoid looking at. And that missing step is the crucial step. Is the crucial step. So that's the only thing I'm adding to you, to what you're
but
saying.
That missing step will disallow the shining, will disallow the joy.
Right.
And
that's where most of us, there's the condition of humanity, unfortunately, to an altogether regrettable extent, as in some of the examples we talked about earlier. So what I'm saying is that it's great to look at the place we want to go to, but I'm saying, number one, you have to see where you are first, be honest about that, and then enable the cultivation that fills that gap where the middle step has to happen between the place of honesty, the dispersal of illusion, and the goal of generosity and love. So, thank you all for coming. Mm-hmm. This has been a lot of fun.
I don't usually get to do this, but thank you.
You're welcome.
And thank you all for being here tonight. As I think many of you know, that we've instituted the time-honored tradition of Donna to support our talks. So we have a donation bowl at the counter.
Donna means generosity.
Yes.
And so we have to do that anonymously.
We can pass out the bowls.
I won't look.
Yeah, we won't look. But the proceeds help support the store and the speakers, so that we can continue to have high-quality events like this. I do want to point out a couple of things on the table here. We have some books. Many of these are from the Fourth Way tradition. There's one booklet here called The Way of Tayu, which is our teacher and founder of Tayu Meditation Center, Robert Innes, created. It's a very succinct, practical guide to many of the ideas that Rob talked about. If you look at all the books on the table, the ratio of wisdom to cost makes this high value. Yeah. But the other thing to notice is that also, a new book has come into a store from a friend of ours who's part of the Lee Loswicks community, called Self-Observation. It's probably one of the best books we've seen on, and one that's very harmonious with our own practice and teaching on self-observation. So this is a new book. Unfortunately, we have like 8 copies, but we sold a bunch. There's only one left here. The other thing that distinguishes it is that our own Robert Schmidt gives a reference on the back here. So he's moving up into the big time. So I encourage anyone interested in these ideas to pick up this book, and pick it up fast, because there's only one of them.
But we'll get more.
Yeah, we will definitely get more in.
What community did you say?
It's the Home HOHM community, run by founded by a teacher named Lee Loswick, who is a Baal Sufi.
And we have our own Tuesday evening study groups here in this space at 7:30 p.m. on every Tuesday except the fourth Tuesday.
And we also